A look at this year's ballot amendments, the new restrictions on Cuba, and a historic hurricane takes on a new meaning. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. There are six amendments on this year's November ballot for Florida voters. They include amendments on who can vote, how we vote, and the state's minimum wage. We're going to go through all of them. Also, the Trump administration has placed new embargoes on Cuba, everything from where tourists can stay to what they can bring back with them to the U.S. How will this impact U.S.-Cuba relations and life back on the island? And finally, we're still in hurricane season. Luckily, we've avoided any big storms so far. Today, we're going to look back at one of the worst storms to ever hit the United States. It devastated the Florida Keys. It's part of our Sundial Book Club conversations. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, there's a lot to keep track of in this year's November ballot. The presidential election is getting a lot of attention, but there are heated congressional races across South Florida, not to mention seats in the state legislature up for grabs, mayoral and county commission races as well. There are also six constitutional amendments that are up for your vote. From raising the state's minimum wage to changing the state's primary elections, these amendments could have a significant impact on your wallets and our democratic system. Joining us now to review these amendments is Skylar Swisher. He's the reporter for the Sun Sentinel covering the story. Skylar, great to have you back.
Glad to be here, Lewis.
So, Skylar, there are six constitutional amendments on the ballot this year. Let's start with the citizenship requirement to vote. This is about changing really just a couple of words, right?
Yeah, so this would just change Florida's constitution from saying that every citizen can vote in elections to saying that only a citizen can vote in elections.
So, again, it's just changing two words. What's the difference?
Well, it doesn't really have any practical effect.
So proponents are arguing that the language is necessary in order to prevent non-citizens from voting in the state. Has this issue come up in local or state elections in the past, or does it stem from rhetoric from the president about undocumented immigrants participating in the elections?
Yeah, it has more to do with the president's rhetoric. There hasn't really been a concerted push to allow non-citizens to vote in elections in Florida. There are a few cities in other states that allow non-citizens to vote in local elections. For instance, San Francisco allows non-citizen parents with children in the school system to vote in school board elections, but I haven't heard of any such effort here in Florida. It's also worth noting that there isn't evidence that non-citizens are voting illegally in elections in Florida. There was a review in 2012 of 180,000 names of the 13 million registered voters in Florida by the Secretary of State and county election officials. That investigation uncovered that only 85 names on the list were not eligible to vote.
The League of Women Voters has come out in opposition of this amendment, arguing that the language is unnecessary.
Are there concerns that
the requirement could prevent individuals from voting if they don't have proper identification at the voting booth?
Yeah, so I haven't heard concerns specific to that issue. Florida law already requires poll workers to request voter ID, and this doesn't really make changes to that. It's worth noting that if the person doesn't have an ID, they can still fill out a provisional ballot, and election officials compare the signature on that provisional ballot to the signature that's on record. I think the bigger objection here is that it just doesn't really have any practical effect, and it's not going to change anything in regards to non-citizen voting.
All right, let's move to Amendment 2. This is getting a lot of attention. It's raising Florida's minimum wage over the next 6 years. It would move up to $10 an hour next year and raise it to $1 every year till the year 2026. Where does Florida's minimum wage stand now, and how does that compare to other states across the country?
Okay, so Florida's minimum wage right now is $8.56 per hour. That's higher than the federal minimum wage of $7.25 per hour, but it's lower than other states, particularly states in the Northeast and the West Coast. New York State has a minimum wage of $11.80 per hour. California is $12 per hour. Also, Florida does not allow cities to have a higher minimum wage than the state. So with the cost of living being higher in South Florida, you know, Miami can't have a minimum wage specific just to the city of Miami. That's not the case elsewhere. You know, New York City has a minimum wage of $15 per hour, and so does Los Angeles.
Attorney John Morgan has been the key voice in favor of the amendment. What has been Morgan's argument in favor of the increase?
Yeah, Morgan's just saying that, you know, hey, Florida workers are overdue for a pay increase. You know, he says we are paying workers, this is his quote, slave wages.
Good afternoon. At this time, we bring you special coverage of the Miami-Dade County School Board meeting on 91.3 WLRN. Those listening in the Keys and the Palm Beaches or on our live stream or via smart speaker will hear our regularly scheduled programming. Thank you.
Florida spoke in opposition to the bill. Let's take a listen.
We should live in a free market society. This is a bad for Florida businesses. I will tell you, this will cost Florida jobs, and it's going to hurt families.
All right. This has been a common argument made in opposition to raising the minimum wage for years, the impact that it would have on small businesses. Who are the other big groups fighting in opposition to this raise?
So the Florida Chamber of Commerce and the Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association are both against it. Their concern is that it's going to further strain businesses that are trying to cope with COVID-19. It's going to result in less hiring, and they say that these higher costs will just get passed on to consumers.
And again, it wants to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. That's basically, it would, by 2026, it would be up to $15 an hour. Do we have any polling on this amendment as to where Florida voters stand right now, Skyler?
So earlier this month, there was a Monmouth University poll that came out that showed that 67% of Florida voters plan to support the minimum wage, raising the minimum wage.
All right. So, again, that is Amendment 2. Again, I'm speaking with Skyler Swisher, reporter for the Sun Sentinel. There are 6 constitutional amendments on the ballot this November. You can find more reporting on those amendments by going to WLRN.org. All right. Amendment 3, let's look at that one. It would move the state to an open primary system. We had primary voting back in August and March of this year. Skyler, remind us again how the system currently works.
Right now in Florida, we have a closed primary system. That means if you're a registered Republican, you can vote in the Republican primary. You cannot vote in the Democratic primary. Same goes if you're a registered Democrat, you can vote in the Democratic primary, but you cannot vote in the Republican primary.
You know, proponents of the measure argue that it allows for no party affiliate voters to participate in elections and would force candidates to make their message less partisan. But why are the state's Republican and Democratic parties both opposed to the measure?
Yeah, so this is kind of unusual in the sense that you have Republicans and Democrats agreeing on something. And they're basically saying, hey, this is misleading to voters. They're saying it's not opening the primaries. It's effectively abolishing them because the top two finishers would move on to the general election. So conceivably, you could have two Republicans running against each other in the general election. So they're just saying that this will basically just inject chaos into Florida's electoral process.
And there are people who are concerned that it could actually disproportionately impact majority black districts in the state, right?
Correct. Yeah. So the concern here is that if you open up a primary election in a majority black district, you could get an influx of independent and Republican voters who previously weren't allowed to vote in that primary election. And perhaps they could be less likely to support black candidates.
And presidential primary elections would not be impacted by this?
That's right. Yeah, presidential primary elections are not affected. This applies to the state legislature, the governor's race, and cabinet-level positions, which would be like the chief financial officer, attorney general, agriculture commissioner. It's effective January 1st. 2024.
All right, that's Amendment 3. Now, I just wanted to mention that we did discuss Amendment 4 on this program last week. We've included a link to that conversation that we had with Orlando Sentinel reporter Jason Garcia. In summary, it would change how constitutional amendments would be passed in years to come. Please check that conversation out. I want to move over to Amendment 5. This is related to the homestead assessments, looking specifically at the Save Our Homes, Our Home benefits. Skyler, what would the amendment mean for homestead property values?
So this would basically allow you to extend the time for you to transfer your Save Our Home benefit from 2 years to 3 years. So a lot of people say that's kind of a loophole in the law. This just would give you more time to transfer that tax benefit that you have.
And would it impact local government revenues?
Yeah, it would. I mean, it's not a huge amount when you look at it statewide, but there would be an effect. It's $1.8 million beginning fiscal year 2021-22, and that would eventually grow to $10.2 million a hit to local property tax revenues across the state.
All right. And finally, Amendment 6, again, connected to the homestead property tax discount, specifically, though, for veterans. How would the amendment help veterans and their families, but again, negatively impact local governments?
Right. So the benefit for veterans is that permanently disabled veterans get a tax break on their property taxes. This would allow the surviving spouse of that veteran to continue to receive that tax benefit. In terms of the hit on tax revenue, school tax revenues for districts across the state would initially fall by $400,000 with a recurring loss of $1.6 million. Statewide non-school property tax revenue would fall initially by $600,000 with a recurring loss of $2.4
million. All right. In the November 2018 election, Amendment 4, i.e. people with felony convictions regaining their voting rights, gained a significant amount of national attention. Do you see the minimum wage law being the most significant in this year's election cycle?
Yeah, I think the minimum wage law will capture the most attention both statewide and nationally, mainly because it's just something that is easy for voters to understand and it generates strong opinions on both sides. But I think Amendment 3 and 4 could really have some major long-lasting effects on the state. Amendment 3, which is the one dealing with primaries, would radically change how elections are conducted in Florida. And Amendment 4, which basically would require one of these constitutional amendments to pass twice instead of just once, would further erode direct democracy, making it much more difficult for citizens and special interests to bypass the conservative Florida legislature in Tallahassee.
What do you think? I mean, are the amendments getting enough attention? I mean, this is a presidential race, and so obviously that's going to suck all the air out of the room. But, you know, you have also big congressional races. There's a lot going on. You know, for voters this year. And so you worry that sometimes some of these other initiatives that are going to be on the ballot might fall behind. I mean, are people talking about it enough? Is it getting enough attention?
Yeah, I mean, I talked to some political scientists for a story I did about this. And what they said was basically that they don't see these amendments really moving the dial in terms of voter turnout. There's just so much noise that's going on with the presidential election. Also, they don't really think any of these amendments are huge blockbusters other than perhaps the minimum wage.
It's a presidential race, and it's probably one of the most heated presidential races we've seen in recent history. Skylar Swisher is a reporter for the Sun Sentinel. Again, learn more about the 6 constitutional amendments on this year's ballot. Go to WLRN.org. Skylar, thanks again. Always appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, still to come, new restrictions on where you can stay in Cuba if you travel there and what you can bring back to the United States. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, the Trump administration has placed a new series of sanctions against Cuba. Last week, President Trump announced Americans can no longer import Cuban cigars and rum. They also won't be able to stay in hotels funded by the Cuban government. Yesterday, the State Department further restricted remittances to Cuba by sanctioning a military-controlled company that is involved in financial transactions. U.S. officials say this is part of their fight against communist oppression. Others say these measures hurt the Cuban people more than the government. Well, joining us now is Colin Laverty. He's the president of Cuba Educational Travel Agency, the company that works with schools and organizations to facilitate travel to Cuba. Colin, thanks so much for the time. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Also joining us is Mike Bustamante. He is an assistant professor of Latin American history at Florida International University, and he specializes in Cuba and Cuban American studies. Mike, also great to have you. Thanks so much. All right, I think we have Mike there. If not, we'll hope to check on that connection. Colin, let me start with you. Have these sanctions, or these new sanctions, did they come to you as a surprise?
No, I don't think they do come as a surprise. I think we're familiar by now that Cuba tends to be an election item. And, you know, despite the fact that there's no travel to Cuba at the moment and there hasn't been travel for the last 6 months, which makes the timing of being very suspect in terms of their actual purpose and effectiveness, I think, you know, many people in the travel industry and, you know, political analysts felt that it would be possible that the Trump administration would take other measures, not so much focused on having an impact on the island, but more so on having an impact on the Cuban-American vote in South Florida.
When's the last time you were in Cuba, Colin?
A little bit before kind of the COVID-19 closure, which would be at the end of March, beginning of April, is when Cuba closed its borders and really has kept their borders closed for the last 6 months.
Yeah. Mike, I think we have you there. Mike Bustamante, you there? Hello, Mike? All right, we're still trying to get that connection cleared up. Colin, how often do you go to Cuba?
Quite frequently. I'd say I spend a great deal of time there. I travel back and forth frequently. As you mentioned in the introduction, we do all kinds of different, we lead a lot of groups to Cuba. We do a lot of events. One of the other measures that was put intact last week was canceling cultural events. And unfortunately, that'll affect us greatly. We've done a number of concert series and kind of public performances, which is one of the things that was changed, as well as conferences and meetings. We've worked with a lot of business associations and other groups on organizing their events in Cuba. So, you know, we'll have to see how this plays out. As I mentioned, there's actually no travel to Cuba at the moment. So I think folks in Cuba and folks that have family in Cuba are interested in seeing the results of the election in November, and then, of course, what happens with coronavirus, how that'll travel to the island in the future.
Yeah, pandemic and a U.S. election. All right, again, Mike Bustamante is an assistant professor of Latin American history at FIU. Mike, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me. Sorry for the connection issues.
No problem at all. It happens. Mike, you know, most recently, the State Department added the American International Services to a list of restricted entities. Now, this is a company controlled by the Cuban military involved in dollar remittances. What's the goal here?
Yeah, this is really part and parcel of a, you know, almost 3-year-old or more attempt by the Trump administration to really, A, undo everything that the Obama administration did on U.S.-Cuba policy, but also particularly since 2019, kind of exert what they call maximum pressure on the Cuban government. The thing is, when you sort of sanction remittances, you're hurting Cuban families most directly far more than the government, in my view. And so in the midst of a pandemic and Cuba's biggest economic crisis in 30 years, you know, I find this measure a really tough one to swallow.
Can the goal be met through these means?
I don't think so. I mean, I think their goal in some sense is, you know, they would like the Cuban military affiliated companies to sort of not be the intermediary for these remittance transfers. But let's say the Cuban state creates another banking entity that's not explicitly under the military's jurisdiction, but say a different ministry. Is that going to satisfy the folks who are behind this policy in Washington? I doubt it. You know, I think most concerning for me is, you know, if you want to get the Cuban military out of the, again, is not the middleman in this remittance traffic, that may be a goal worth discussing. But, you know, short of an alternative that's already lined up and put in place in advance, just cutting off remittance flows right now when they're so crucial to particularly the elderly in Cuba, you know, again, the humanitarian effects here, I think, outweigh any chance of this, you know, getting the Cuban government to move their own internal policies.
What can we learn, Mike, from history about U.S. pressure on a repressive regime? What do we learn from the past?
I think the record's pretty clear. You know, for save a few moments, for example, the Carter administration and certainly the Obama administration, when U.S. policies for Cuba was different. Attempts to pressure the Cuban government into changing their internal policies just haven't worked, right? Cuba, interestingly, this summer kind of came out and seemed to, raise expectations again that they're going to move forward with certain economic reforms that are long overdue. But that was really a response to the impact of the coronavirus on the Cuban economy. The record of the Trump administration's particular, pressure campaign, like pressure campaigns before it, hasn't worked. I don't think there's a good case to be made for that policy having those kinds of results.
But we look at the fact that, again, the Cuban government has benefited from remittances to the island, according to the Havana Consulting Group, even appropriating almost 74% of every dollar sent. That adds up to a lot of money. So does that put enough pressure on the military and the government? Taking that away.
I don't think it will. There's not a good record or any track record of the Cuban government responding to threats in this way. And I think when you are weakening, citizens too in the process, again, the chances of citizens themselves then, sort of going to their government and asking for a change, I don't see that as very likely. Look, the Cuban government does act as a middleman. They're in a hard currency crunch, right? They're in a hard currency crunch in part because of a deep legacy of U.S. sanctions. So yes, they have turned to remittance flows as one way to sort of adjust their balance sheets. But that's not to say that Cuban citizens don't benefit from those flows as well.
Yeah, Colin, tell me about the significance of these remittances to folks back in Cuba.
Well, I think Michael hit it on the nose. It's a really tough economic time in Cuba, like most of the rest of the world. It's an economy that's highly dependent on tourism, which there's none of that happening. And the Trump administration has kind of gradually over the last 3 years certainly diminished the amount of American travel. You also have a huge informal economy that normally depends on travel back and forth by Cuban Americans and Cubans living off the island that are bringing things. All of that's halted. So you really have a very tough economic crisis, and the lifeline for many Cuban families are remittances. I mean, you can see it across the island where there's long lines at Western Union and other places where Cubans are essentially going, they're getting their remittances, and then they're going next door to the food store and they're buying food. And so these remittances are literally taking, these measures to suffocate remittances are literally taking food off the table of average Cubans. And, I'd say I agree with Michael that you might be intending to hurt the government, but at the end of the day, the collateral damage is with average Cubans that aren't doing anything other than being born on the island to survive.
So, Colin, with these sanctions against, this specific military-controlled company, then what other options do people have for remittances?
Well, luckily, it seems that Western Union has, survived. This is not the first swipe that the Trump administration has taken against remittances. There was some other measures announced months ago. It seems that probably I would guess not because of their concern for the Cuban on the island, but more because of the political backlash in Miami. They haven't gone after Western Union because they know that that's kind of the last piece that will really create significant hardship. So this is important because it makes it more complicated, but luckily there's still another option. The Western Union for now has survived. I suspect that the Marco Rubios, the Diaz Villar, and others that are really pushing the Trump administration and are the architects behind this policy would like to potentially stop Western Union from operating, but I think their calculus also shows that would create such hardship that there'd probably be backlash in Miami, for really pushing people over the edge in terms of poverty and a lack of means to survive.
Again, I'm talking with Colin Laverty, president of Cuba Educational Travel, and also Mike Bustamante. He is an assistant professor of Latin American history at Florida International University, specializing in Cuba and Cuban American studies. We are talking about the most recent U.S. sanctions in Cuba, again, brought on by the Trump administration. Mike, I want to come to you on this and ask you, some people reject the criticism that these sanctions aggravate the situation of people in Cuba. U.S. officials say the embargo has exceptions for food and medical supplies. Do these exceptions really help the Cuban people, or is it just putting more strain on them?
You know, there are some exemptions in the embargo law, perhaps the most well-known, and it's a result of a law passed in Congress in 2000 that allows for U.S. agricultural exports to the island. And those exports are important, no doubt. And so, but oftentimes, you know, these exceptions in the embargo, kind of surrounding them are just a whole series of kind of regulations and rules that often lead, say, U.S. businesses that might take advantage of them to say, why do I want to deal with that? It's too complicated. You know, the exports of food from the U.S. to Cuba have kind of gone up and down over the years. It's a pretty sizable flow. Medicines, much less so. And I think, look, you know, the argument that because there are exceptions in the embargo, therefore the embargo doesn't really have an effect, you know, or isn't aggravating Cuban's economic difficulties, I think that just fails on its merits. I would never, you know, insist that Cuba's economic problems are solely a result of U.S. sanctions. There are deep economic reforms that are needed and that hopefully can move forward. But to deny that U.S. sanctions have an impact on the Cuban economy is to deny the very logic that undergird their implementation in the first place, and has continued to be part of the logic of the policy for those who defend it. The idea is pressure cooker economically equals you know, popular revolt to take down the government, and we have 60 years of evidence that just isn't the case.
And really, in the end, we're trying to put pressure on the Cuban government to cut its support, especially of Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro. But is there anything that tells us these sanctions will do that?
Not in my view. You know, the Trump administration has had kind of this almost, you know, domino theory of you know, U.S. Latin American relations in recent years, particularly focused on Cuba and Venezuela. You take one down, the other goes, right? And it seems to work in both ways, according to their calculus. In my estimation, what this sort of maximum pressure campaign has done is just compel Cuba and Venezuela to cling closer to the bonds that they have with one another, right? They don't take kindly, Cuba especially, to this these kinds of threats, and they have very little incentive right now to break with Venezuela, right? And I don't think that this this policy, you know, presents them with a viable alternative, you know, from the point of view of realpolitik, which is, you know, the real world that we're dealing with, good or bad.
So, Colin, last week the President Trump announced restrictions on the importation of alcohol and tobacco from Cuba, also not allowing American travelers to stay in hotels or properties that are controlled by the Cuban government. How does that impact you and your business?
Well, you know, at the moment, not at all, because there's no travel at the moment, and there hasn't been for 6 months. I think the real question will be, you know, does President Trump get reelected? And if so, then that'll have a very significant impact on travel. There's a lot of travelers that prefer to stay in hotels, or depending on the type of travel they're doing, they really need to stay in hotels. There is kind of a flourishing community of Airbnbs and small boutique hotels that are non-government. But restricting hotels certainly will limit travel. I'd also say, you know, it's just more of kind of this confusing and scary narrative about Cuba. We went from a situation under the Obama administration where there was kind of a psychology of it's legal to travel to Cuba, it's safe to travel to Cuba. And so this is another measure that kind of really impacts the average American when they're choosing a destination and they're confused whether they're allowed to go to Cuba or not.
Yeah,
I think it'll have a significant impact on demand.
And what about the pandemic? How has that impacted travel?
I mean, really, it's cut off travel altogether. Cuba closed its borders about 6 months ago, so there's no travel going on at all. The one thing that I will just point out that's interesting is that, you know, President Trump, before he was elected, you know, he had his team from the Trump organization come to Cuba almost a dozen times, potentially violating the embargo, to look at entering into business agreements with the Cuban government to build hotels and resorts. So it's quite, I don't know if you want to say comical or disappointing, that this measure is something that runs contrary to his personal and his business beliefs over the course of his career.
So President Trump has tried to do business in Cuba. How far did that get?
Well, you know, partly because the embargo was still very much in place, it didn't get that far. He was looking at opportunities, but he actually, you know, he had his associates travel here and look at a number of properties. And even as recent as 2018, he re-registered his trademark, not only for hotels, but beauty pageants and other business initiatives. So, you know, at the time that he's kind of telling you one thing about, you know, punishing the Cuban government and not engaging with the Cuban government, his business has actually been constantly exploring possibilities to doing business in Cuba. And it wouldn't surprise me by any means if down the road when he's out of office, he continues to look at engaging with the communist government of Cuba to do business.
And, of course, the Miami Herald's done a lot of reporting on this as well. You know what, just to finish up here, Mike, let me start with you. What about the timing for all these sanctions? I mean, we're barely 4.5 weeks from an election.
Yeah, it's unmistakable. You know, to be rather blunt, and maybe I shouldn't be, I think if anyone really thinks that President Trump has a kind of a deep abiding preoccupation with Cuba, I'd venture to say they're sorely mistaken. The domestic political calculus, I think, for him has been clear from the start of his rollback of the Obama administration's policy. He was convinced somehow that he won 80% of the Cuban vote in Florida in 2016, which just wasn't the case. What you have seen since 2016 is a steady flow of visits, both from President Trump himself and high, you know, important members of his administration to Miami to, you know, sell this policy. And they absolutely see it as a ticket, you know, to or part of the contributing factor to their hopes of winning Florida. So I wouldn't be surprised if in the next couple of weeks there we didn't have a further kind of drip of other measures that allow them to sort of really keep this narrative going, even if, as I argued before, I think the effects are going to be minimal or, you know, hurt the Cuban people first and foremost.
And Colin, have you heard from Cubans here in the diaspora? What do they say about this? Does this win over Cuban votes?
Well, I think that remains to be seen. You know, Michael talked about kind of the changing politics in South Florida. Certainly, you know, the Obama administration engaged with the Cuban government and that was able to win them votes in Florida. And they really, you know, split the vote amongst Cuban Americans. And there's a lot of work being done on studying if, you know, President Trump's policy of getting tough with Cuba will win him votes or if it's other attributes that he has that are making him popular with the Cuban American votes. So I think we'll have to wait and see. I think what's clear is Cuban Americans that have family on the island and have a relationship with the island are clearly affected and they're clearly worried about the well-being of their family. A drop in travel and certainly restrictions on remittances just leads to, you know, increased suffering. And I think it's clear. I mean, it's hard to find any Cuban in Cuba or elsewhere that thinks that the Cuban government is kind of on its knees and it's going to fall. So it's really a debate between those that choose to try and punish the Cuban government and don't worry about the fact that that's also hurting the average Cuban versus those that say, let's engage because that's going to significantly improve the lives of average Cubans who are supposedly the people that we care about and not the focus of U.S. policy.
Absolutely. Colin Laverty is the president of Cuba Educational Travel and Mike Bustamante, assistant professor of Latin American history at FIU. He specializes in Cuba and Cuban American studies. Mike, Colin, thanks so much for the time and the insight. I appreciate it.
Thanks to you.
Thank you.
All right. Still to come, we're going to head back to the Great Depression era Florida Keys and hear the story of the infamous Labor Day hurricane of 1935. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. For September, our book club read The Last Train to Key West by Chanel Cleeton. It follows three women who are each undergoing life-changing experiences, but are all brought together in the Florida Keys during one of history's biggest natural disasters. The story begins in Key West, but ends in the Upper Keys just as the infamous 1935 Labor Day hurricane strikes. Now, you can learn more about the book and the author by going to our Facebook group, Sundial Book Club. Joining us now to discuss the book is WLRN's Keys reporter, Nan Klinginer, from the Southernmost Bureau. Nan, always great to have you.
Thanks, Louis. Good to be here.
Also joining us via Skype is Willie Dry. He is the author of the book, Storm of the Century, the 1935 Labor Day Hurricane. Willie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Luis. It's good to talk with you again.
Oh, great to have you back. As I remember, we talked about this last year. Mm-hmm. By the way, I want to mention that anybody who read the book, please share with us on social media your thoughts about the book. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. You know, Nan, you actually recommended this book and the author to us for September. Tell us about Chanel Cleeton and why. What was it about this book that jumped at you?
Yeah, well, Chanel is an accomplished writer of historical fiction, mostly centering on the stories of Cuban and Cuban-American women. And historical fiction is really my jam, you know. I love, like, Hilary Mantel's books and Tracy Chevalier and Sarah Waters and those writers. And it, I love books about Florida and especially the Keys. So, you know, it's kind of like Chanel Cleeton wrote this book just for me. and what I really enjoyed about it was looking at the story of that time in the Keys and that hurricane through a woman's perspective and telling their story. Because, you know, To Have and Have Not is set in Key West in the 30s. And there are lots of books about the hurricane and the veterans and the railroad and the building of the railroad, but you don't hear a lot from women. So it was just, I really appreciated hearing those voices and being in their stories.
And it wasn't just one. She told the story through the perspective of three women, bringing three different stories together and the way they all tie in together, even though they're separate people, how they find each other. Willie, this book is, as I said, set during the infamous 1935 Labor Day hurricane. Chanel told us about why she found herself drawn to that storm as part of the storyline. Here's what she said.
It really was the Labor Day hurricane that kind of sparked my interest in writing this book. And I just came across it, I think it was during Hurricane Irma coverage. There was a mention of some of the strongest and deadliest storms to hit the United States. And I grew up in Florida, you know, was educated in Florida for a large part of my formative years. And it was a storm I had never heard of. And I was really surprised by that, to have been in the state and for the impact it had on the state to be kind of forgotten to some extent. And so I was really intrigued when I first heard about it. And then when I heard of the plight of the World War I veterans who were down there working in the camps, building the overseas highway, and, you know, kind of, I had always sort of thought of the World War I veterans as being, you know, this generation that was venerated for their military service. And then to see that they weren't actually treated that way in the aftermath was also really illuminating for me.
So, Willie, for you, I'm wondering, what is, because you wrote a whole book about this storm. What's the draw to that storm? Why?
Well, the thing that attracted me to this story, most hurricane stories are very dramatic and they're very compelling, but the plot is very, very simple. The storm forms, the storm comes ashore. It does damage. Maybe it kills people and moves on. The survivors pick up the pieces and bury the dead and move on. And that plot will basically explain just about every hurricane story that's ever been written. Like Chanel, I was very surprised to learn about the Labor Day hurricane of 1935. And when I started digging into the story, I just found layer upon layer upon layer of complexity. There was the Great Depression. The country was still struggling to get through this terrible period of economic depression. There were the World War I veterans who were there, and they were viewed in many ways as kind of the forgotten man. President Franklin Roosevelt ran on a campaign slogan of "Remember the Forgotten Man," and was elected by a landslide.
And they were down in the Keys, basically. They were working because it was really one of the few places they could find a job.
Right. It was a part of the WPA initiative. The objective was to build a highway to Key West so that you could drive from Miami to Key West. The plan was to turn Key West into a tourist attraction. And, of course, that was a very sound plan. All you got to do is look at Key West today and see that was a sound plan.
Yeah. A very sound plan for them. You know what? Let me ask you about the storm, though, because one of the things that, you know, looking back on history, but also in Chanel's book, what I thought was fascinating is you know, today we take for granted that, you know, you can go to the weather service 24 hours a day and get all the information and radar photos and video. We could see what the storm is doing. They didn't have any of that. So how did people back then know about what a storm could do?
They used their experience, they used their intimate knowledge of their surroundings and signs. The people who lived on the Keys, the people who had grown up on the Keys, knew that there was a storm out there, and they knew that it was a very bad storm. And several of the residents made several attempts to try to encourage the camp administrators to call for a train to come down and get the men off of the Keys, but the administrators just completely misunderstood the danger that they were in.
Yeah.
But the Keys residents were able to tell by swell, by cloud formation, by other subtle indicators. They did not know necessarily exactly where the storm was, but they knew it was out there, and they knew that they were in for a rough time.
Yeah. Again, we're talking about this month's Sundial Book Club, The Last Train to Key West by Chanel Cleeton. We're talking with WLRN's Keys reporter Nan Klinginer and Willie Dry. He's the author of the book Storm of the Century, the 1935 Labor Day Hurricane. That, of course, if you read the book, is part of the story. Hopefully you did read the book. If you did, please let us know on our Facebook page what you thought about it. Nan, you know, some people will have parallels between the Labor Day storm and Hurricane Irma, but how often do people talk about that? How often do people even talk about that storm? I don't know if anybody was around back then that's still alive.
I actually checked with a historian in the Upper Keys this morning, and there are still four survivors.
Wow.
Around and with us. And I interviewed a number of survivors 20 years ago when I was doing an oral history project with the Miami Herald. And I would say it is very much a part of living memory in the Upper Keys. Where those survivors are. And also there's the Hurricane Memorial at mile marker 81.6 in Isla Mirada. And if anybody is driving through the Keys, I highly recommend stopping there. It's a beautiful memorial, and it's actually a crypt. It has the remains of some of the hurricane victims, and it was put up in the 30s. And it's just a beautiful memorial. And so it's part of the living memory in the Upper Keys for sure.
Yeah, I mean, because I'm wondering, like, you know, how hurricanes kind of shape people. And I remember going through the Keys and just people I've talked to who went through Irma, who've been through other more recent hurricanes, and it kind of shaped them in the sense that it made them stubborn. And they're like, you know what, I'm gonna die here. I don't care. That's what I heard. That. Is that what, I mean, is that kind of like the Keys mentality, what hurricanes do to people?
Some people, for sure. I mean, yeah, you have to be willing to endure and cope with you know, forces that are larger than you are and try to come back. And yeah, Irma was a really bad one. It was a Category 4. It destroyed or majorly damaged thousands and thousands of homes. And Hurricane Wilma in 2005, if you talk to people in Key West, you know, we got 6.5 feet of water. Storm surge. And so that was a pretty big one too.
Yeah, living on...
They kind of form these mileposts in your time here, yeah. If you hang around long enough.
Island living is wonderful, but also difficult. Willie, you know, every hurricane, especially major hurricanes, I should say, kind of force us to change, whether it's building codes, laws, whatever. We have to adapt to Mother Nature. What did the Labor Day hurricane do? How did things change after that?
Well, the Labor Day hurricane really marked the end of the old Keys. Much of the lifestyle, much of the means of support was taken away by the Labor Day hurricane of 1935. Just for example, one of the ways that the Keys residents subsisted in those days was many of them planted small vegetable gardens, small produce gardens. Many of the islands up there had the topsoil was just carried away. And this was a very strange very strange phenomenon. You know, the Keys are coral islands. I was in the Keys, the Upper Keys, not long after Irma went through. And Irma did some of the same sorts of things in the Upper Keys. There were places where my wife and I were walking around near the beach, and we saw bare coral exposed.
Yeah.
And that was just, it was just odd and a little bit unsettling to see that. But the Labor Day hurricane of 1935 was sort of the curtain for the really old Keys.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about this briefly. We know Ernest Hemingway spent a great deal of time in Key West. He wrote about the Labor Day hurricane. He brought attention to the treatment and what had happened to many of those World War I veterans. But how did that help shape our understanding of what happened?
Hemingway was a world-famous author by that time. He was his literary star was rising. He had had a couple of best-selling novels. He was becoming internationally famous. He'd had a movie by that time. He had at least one movie made based on one of his novels. So he had name recognition. He was not a fan of President Roosevelt or the New Deal. He did spend some time with some of the vets who came down to the Keys. He was drinking buddies with some of them. The editor of New Masses magazine kind of played a hunch that he didn't like Roosevelt very much either. He kind of played a hunch that Hemingway, not being a Roosevelt fan, might be willing to write an essay for his magazine, and sure enough, he did.
Yeah.
And it was a scathing, accusatory editorial. He basically accused the Roosevelt administration of murder.
Wow.
Speaking for myself, just personally, I think Roosevelt was a good president, but of course, a lot of people don't like him. And a lot of people still don't like him. So there were people who were kind of willing to jump on the criticism of Roosevelt.
Yeah.
But I didn't find any indication that he ordered a cover up. But the people under him certainly went to some great lengths to try to downplay what had happened.
Nan, I want to finish up here with you on this. I mean, we've had a couple different writers on the book club whose books take place in the Keys. And, I wondered from you, because you live there. I've been there a few times, but you live there. What do you think about the depiction? I mean, because Chanel told us she did the research. She went down there. She wanted to talk to people and see what life was like down there. But, you know, your take on how she portrayed life in the Keys and Key West. Did she do it? Did she hit it?
Yeah, I mean, anytime you're writing historical fiction, you're taking this imaginative leap into a place that, you know, you haven't been, right? Or at least a time you haven't been. So that's a particularly creative act, and I certainly bought it, you know? I've led a Key West book club a couple times here with the studios, and I would definitely add this one to the roster. I would just suggest that if people wanted a contemporary account of life in the Keys in the 30s, or at least in Key West, besides Hemingway, and I want to add a warning that was to have and have not, there is a lot of really racist language and portrayals in that novel, so just know that.
Yeah.
The works of Elizabeth Bishop, her essays and letters and poems from Key West, in the 30s, I think, just give you an amazing picture from an outsider coming down, but for someone who's lived here for a while and really appreciated the place. So,
well, as I said, great. Thank you for those pitches, but thank you also for giving us the idea for this book for September. It was a fun read. It really was. I appreciate that. Nan Klingner, again, our Keys reporter from the Southernmost Bureau. Nan, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, Lewis.
And I wanted to thank, William Dry. He is the author of Storm of the Century, talking about that Labor Day storm of 1935. Willie, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Louise. Anytime. Glad to do it.
All right. And again, we'd love to hear from you. Find us on Facebook, Sundial Book Club. Let us know what you thought of the book. Well, that's our program for this Tuesday, September 29th. Coming up tomorrow on the show, Broward schools are facing pressure from the state to reopen ahead of schedule. Education Commissioner Richard Corcoran said that the district needs to open by October 5th or give exemptions why specific schools shouldn't have to. We're going to hear from Broward County School Superintendent Robert Runcie, and we're going to take your questions. We also go from primary and secondary schools to higher ed. College campuses across the state are struggling to contain the spread of the coronavirus. Kathy Hebda is the chancellor of Florida's college system. She'll explain what's being done on an administrative level to track the virus and the workplace training initiatives that are in place. Finally, Brenda Alford has been a jazz and gospel singer performing in Miami for decades and worked with some of the titans of the industry. She'll talk with us about songs of protest and how jazz and the Black Lives Matter movement intersect. And how quickly time has flown. Thursday marks the start of October, which means we have a new book for you to get started now. This month's selection is Kent Russell's In the Land of Good Living, Journey to the Heart of Florida. Over the summer of 2016, Kent and his two friends walked the state of Florida from the Panhandle to Kent's hometown, Coconut Grove. Again, you can find out more about the book. Join our book club. Find us on Facebook. Just look up Sundial Book Club. It's free, so just ask to join. We'd love to have you. And also share with us some of the other books that you've been reading this summer. Well, I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks again for listening. As always, stay safe, but be good to each other. We'll be back again live tomorrow.